Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Michael O'Neill, U.S. Communications Manager for the Green Party. Mr. O'Neill has over 15 years of political communications experience, with 12 of those spent with the Green Party in everything from street canvassing to national press relations. He served as staff on the 2010 New York gubernatorial campaign that won back ballot status for the Green Party in the state for the first time since 2002. In the 2014 and 2018 gubernatorial campaigns, he helped sustain the party's ballot status in the roles of downstate coordinator and campaign manager, respectively. In 2016, Mr. O'Neill was hired as the assistant to the campaign manager for Jill Stein's presidential campaign, a capacity in which he co-managed the campaign's Brooklyn, New York office and produced various events and live streams. He joins me to discuss the past, present, and future of the Green Party. Welcome to Deconstructed, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. You know, a lot of people may have misconceptions about the Green Party, and I thought a good place to bring clarity is to touch upon the 10 key values of the Green Party. So let's start with grassroots democracy. What does that mean from a value standpoint?
With the Green Party's history as an alternative party in the United States, emerging in the late 80s into the early 90s, it has always been steeped in a fight against the entrenched oligarchic duopoly of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And so the way the four pillars work and the 10 key values work is that we understand that we're probably not going to win any of them unless we win all of them. And that's what makes them so central to our mission. And so grassroots democracy being front and center with our 10 key values demonstrates our commitment to how we as an alternative party and the people whose interests would be represented by us must achieve actual democracy, grassroots democracy in this system in order for anything else to follow from that. Grassroots democracy means that decision-making power should reside as close to the grassroots as possible. It should reside as close to the people who are directly impacted by the decisions that are being made as possible. And not just in the realm of government, but also in the workplace. We believe in workplace grassroots democracy. So it's an understanding that comes out of our origin as an organization and a party that is trying to uproot this entrenched duopoly that has had its boot on the neck of U.S. politics for so long.
Another one of your values, and you have some that overlap, like social justice and equal opportunity. You focus on feminism and gender equity. How do you best position that? And is the Green Party a meritocracy-focused party?
Neoliberalism has given meritocracy a bad rap, from my perspective anyway. So that would be a term I don't normally lean into. But social justice and equal opportunity reflects our value that you're not going to have grassroots democracy and you're not going to have any of the other 10 key values unless you have justice and solidarity and equity across the many identities that make up our society. That if people are being discriminated against, are being repressed, are being oppressed because of their gender expression or their sexual orientation or their ethnic background or their race as it's constructed in this society, then you can't have grassroots democracy. You can't have ecological wisdom. There will be no nonviolence, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the sense that everyone has the right to live and thrive in our society, that's the angle that we're coming at in terms of social justice. We're not looking to kind of demographically justify a 1% that lords over the rest of the 99% of us in terms of, for instance, unequal distribution of wealth. It's about everyone, regardless of your personal history, your identity, everyone having the chance to, not just the chance, but everyone having the right to live a decent and just life with your loved ones in your community.
Decentralization is another element restructuring social, political, and economic institutions away from the powerful few and making things less bureaucratic. You also talk about community-based economics, distilling it more to the local level. Does that suggest that the Green Party is a strong proponent of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, for example?
Decentralization gets back to that idea that the people who are in the position to make a decision about something should be the people who are most directly impacted by that decision. And we have a interesting balance to strike as a party because on the one hand, we call for a Green New Deal. And we talk about a World War II scale mobilization to combat the climate catastrophe. That will require large scale public works and public planning and large scale investment in that kind of work. But we are not looking to have some remote decision making bureaucracy decide where the less scenic aspects of the new green energy economy are going to be situated in such a way that the same communities that are typically low-income communities or communities of color that have had to deal with the waste dumps and the power plants and things like that, that those communities will also get the disproportionate share of whatever the aspects of the new energy infrastructure, the hard elements of that infrastructure might look like, that the transition that we make into a Green New Deal needs to be equitable, and that communities that have been victimized by highway placement and even going back to the railroads and the ways that we have allocated infrastructure in this country, that those same marginalized communities are not re-marginalized or further marginalized by the next wave of development. So that's an example of how decentralization might work, that if a community is going to be particularly impacted by, say, a solar array or a field of wind turbines or power transmission lines, that they have an equitable and just say in how that infrastructure is designed and built because it's going to be impacting them. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Now, you've mentioned ecological wisdom, which is one of your values. You also have future focus and sustainability. So looking at those two, how would you best frame the Green Party's approach when it talks about a Green New Deal so that people have a better understanding of what that actually means?
For me, combining ecological wisdom and future focus conjures a vision of sustainability that is tightly committed to an understanding that our planet has limits, that the capacity of our environment to handle the waste that we produce as a society and the energy and other resources that we consume as a society has limits. But at the same time, we are not a party that is defined by a kind of hair shirt understanding of austerity, that the only way to preserve the environment or to avoid a climate catastrophe would be to recede as a civilization. Now, there might be aspects of our consumption or the way that we consume at a large scale as a civilization that need to be reined in, but this is not a puritanical understanding of ecological wisdom. One of the reasons I feel so passionately about a Green New Deal is that by engaging in a just transition and a truly transformative eco-socialist Green New Deal, is that we actually have the potential to have more amenities and more services and more public infrastructure to grant people those opportunities to live and thrive. That actually capitalism as it's currently constructed in fossil fuel capitalism, it delivers abundance in very narrow ways There are a few ways in which it delivers massive abundance, but then there's actually a lot of austerity in many other parts of our lives in terms of the austerity of our time and the ability to connect. And that if you don't have the personal money for your own car or your own home or like a suburban McMansion or what have you, that you're actually cut off from a lot of things that our society has to offer or could have to offer. So a truly wise implementation of ecological principles will actually end up with more for everyone. While I do concede that the people who are water skiing behind five super yachts at a time, they're probably going to have to do with less. But frankly, I'm less concerned with them and them having to scale back their consumption.
Great points, Michael. We're going to take a quick break and talk more about the Green Party when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Michael O'Neill, the Green Party's U.S. Communications Manager, which is a very big job. And Michael, thank you for that overview on the complex values of the Green Party. I think you really help people get a better sense of what the Green Party is about. Now let's talk about some current issues. H.R. 1, for example, the For the People Act, as it's been postured. What's the Green Party's view on H.R. 1, and particularly where that bill talks about election reform?
H.R. 1 is really a masterclass in cynical Democratic Party policymaking, in that they bundled some desperately needed election justice reforms with a couple diabolical poison pills that are designed to eliminate competition from alternative parties in presidential elections. So in the headlines that you see on progressive news sites and at various good government groups, you hear about H.R. 1 as the For the People Act, having all these voter protections and other ways to kind of federalize some of the better voter protection standards we have in different states. But what they don't tell you is that the poison pills all have to do with moving the goalposts for public federal matching funds that are available to presidential primary candidates during election years. And that the Green Party, for example, has been actually able to make use of these public federal matching funds that people pay into through their tax dollars that enable everyday people to seriously compete and run for president who are not already millionaires or billionaires or who are not already career politicians. And since 2012, the Green Party has been able to raise the amount of funds that are necessary to qualify for presidential primary matching funds, which prior to H.R. 1, that would be $5,000 in each of 20 states. So from 2012 to 2020, Green Party candidates running for president were able to meet that qualification of raising $5,000 in small dollar contributions in each of 20 states. H.R. 1 would have quintupled that criteria to $25,000 in each of 20 states. So what you see is you have a program, federal matching funds for presidential primary candidates, which is designed to facilitate outsiders running for office. And then you have an alternative party like the Green Party making consistent use of that program. And the response from the Democrats is, well, we better change that program because we don't want the Green Party making use of that program, even though on paper, that's what it's designed for. So they wanted to move the goalpost essentially to put that assistance in the form of public matching funds out of reach by quintupling it from $5,000 in 20 states to $25,000 in 20 states. And at the same time, they would have been unleashing a flood of money from their own national party coffers into their candidates. And I can go into a bit more detail about that, but I first wanted to see if you had any questions or follow-up questions about what I just threw at you, because I know it's a lot and it's really in the weeds of the bill.
Well, I personally am painfully aware of the differences in the treatments of major party candidates and minor party candidates. And a lot of people don't understand that distinction, but the Libertarian Party and the Green Party would be considered minor parties within the context of the FEC and related regulations. And what they really are doing, if people are fond of using Jim Crow 2.0 language today to say there are attempts to craft voting regulations against minorities, this is one of those issues, except the minority they're going against are parties like the Libertarian Party and the Green Party. So you're spot on with your assessment. Let's move on. I want to make sure we can cover some additional things. President Biden has more than confused me on the climate in recent days and in the context of his infrastructure package, which is on again, off again, on again, off again, walk back, and so forth. Where do you think the Biden administration stands relative to the climate and the infrastructure package?
I think the Biden administration has caved to their fossil fuel donors and to the Republican Party. And this is so typical of how the Democratic Party handles the threat of a climate catastrophe. I like to say that Republicans are climate crisis deniers. Democrats are climate solutions deniers. The Democrats behave as if they are just kind of oblivious about what it will actually take for us as a society to meet the threat of a climate catastrophe and the scale that's necessary for transforming our society in a just way away from fossil fuel consumption. But we're actually going to be putting out a statement on this, and we're running out of time to avoid climate collapse. And so in order to get a sign-off from the climate-denying Republicans and their hordes of special interest donors, Biden says that he understands the need to halt fossil fuels, but his actions continue to show otherwise, because in this latest bill, it's actually granting permits for more fossil fuel infrastructure. So there's going to be this Line 3 pipeline project to Enbridge Energy. And by granting permits for the construction of that, the Biden administration is locking us into years, if not decades, of making use of this fossil fuel infrastructure. And that's time that we don't have. That's CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions that the atmosphere will not be able to process without it changing conditions on this planet in a way that will be lethal for millions and possibly billions of people. So the green infrastructure aspects that were promised by Biden during the campaign were walked back severely in this. Biden originally asked for $213 billion to improve energy efficiency of homes and $100 billion for energy efficient schools. But the deal with the GOP will spend $579 billion mostly on expanding fossil fuel infrastructure, because we're talking about freeways, we're talking about airports, and also promoting privatization. So the green infrastructure deal was turned into a dirty infrastructure deal. And it does not include investments for green energy jobs or funds to combat the climate crisis. It is a bill that was seemingly crafted with complete obliviousness to either climate catastrophe as a crisis or the Green New Deal as the solution to that crisis.
At the risk of being a little sarcastic, I hope that perhaps your party can influence the Biden administration as well and let them know that we're in a single biosphere. So when they approve pipelines for other countries, that doesn't help.
Right.
Let's talk about New York's ranked choice voting. They just had a primary that was driven by RCV, and there's now discussion about general elections and so forth moving that way. There seems to be a movement. The Green Party has been very, very proactive relative to legislation and so forth to create viable election reform. Would you like to comment on what's transpiring in New York?
It's a great thing when more people get a chance to try empowered methods like ranked choice voting and proportional representation. Our Greens in New York City agitated heroically and passionately for ranked choice voting in both primaries and general elections when that was being deliberated during the Charter Review Commission for the city charter. Ranked choice voting was only implemented for primaries, which was a little disappointing for us. And when people talk about ranked choice voting in New York City, we want people to understand that it's only for primaries at this point. And so while that was a little disappointing, it's great that all those voters in New York City get a taste of ranked choice voting in the primary, because that's going to create legions of new converts who will be agitating and demanding that for general elections. When people use ranked choice voting, they love it. And by ranked choice voting, look, I know I'm talking to the IVN Deconstructed podcast. I'm sure this is a core audience for alternative voting, but just in case people aren't familiar with ranked choice voting, you get to rank your candidates in order of preference. So if there are four candidates running and you really like one of them, but you're not sure that person's going to win, you're okay with the second person, but and maybe that one's the front runner. And maybe there's a third that you're also like, you feel like you could live with. But the fourth candidate, who maybe also has a really strong campaign and you really don't want that person getting elected, then when you go to your voting spot on election day, you could rank the candidates that you want in order of preference 1, 2, and 3. You can leave the fourth one off entirely if you want to. And if after the first choice candidates, the candidates who are ranked first on the different ballots, if there's no majority winner, then the candidate with the fewest votes gets eliminated, and all the ballots for that candidate then go to the second choice listed on each of those ballots. And the upshot is that it means that you can vote for the person you really want, rather than just being worried about protecting yourself from the candidate who you fear the most. And elections in the United States are dominated by a politics of fear, where you're told that it's more important to vote against who you fear rather than to vote for the candidate that actually reflects your values. And that is one of the primary ways that the Democratic and Republican parties maintain their cartel and their stranglehold on U.S. politics. So we look forward to people coming out of this primary contest being evangelists for ranked choice voting. And also, I just want to say that New York City once had proportional representation back in the Mayor LaGuardia days in the 1930s. And that's actually where we see the most transformative potential for overlooked communities and alternative parties getting representation in government. But ranked choice voting is a good stepping stone to that. But we always want to make sure that proportional representation is in the conversation.
Well, Michael, we're going to take a quick break and talk about the future of the Green Party when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Michael O'Neill, U.S. Communications Manager for the Green Party. Michael, we've talked about a variety of different things, but let's talk about some of the numbers associated with the Green Party. How many members do you currently have?
Well, the funny thing is that our crazy patchwork system of state-by-state election laws means that you have some states where you're not allowed to register in a political party, and then you have some states where you can only register in a political party if it has official party recognition through getting a certain number of votes, maybe for a statewide office or another office. And then you have states where the Greens have ballot status. So for example, in the state of New York, there are between 20 and 25,000 registered Greens who are registered with the Green Party in the Board of Elections. And so I think extrapolating upon that, you could put it in the, you know, hundreds of thousands territory. And I think that we as a party, because we don't have ballot status recognition in every state, that brings to the fore one of the many aspects of how this political system discriminates against alternative parties, in that not even having consistency between what is a party member state by state makes it challenging to run a political party. And that is one of the ways that this system makes it opaque and difficult for everyday people to really participate in the political process, because the laws are not only very complex, but they actually conflict with each other from state to state. And it's designed that way to keep the levers of political power out of the hands of everyday people.
How many Green Party members currently hold federal, state, or local office?
As of September of last year, at least 117 Greens hold elected office. And since 1985, Greens have won at least 1,220 races, including at least 145 partisan races. Last year, we saw the election of Emmanuel Estrada to mayor of Baldwin Park, California, a pretty substantially sized town in Los Angeles County, and that was very exciting for us. And we also have, for example, Cam Gordon, who is a fantastic representative on the City Council of Minneapolis, who is running for re-election this year. And in Minneapolis, they have ranked choice voting, which is one of the reasons that Cam has been able to represent Green Party values there in office over the number of terms that he has.
And what's next for the Green Party? I know you have an annual national meeting coming up. What are you focusing on?
The theme for this year's annual national meeting is a reflection of a lot of the national struggle and upheaval that we've seen over the last year. So that theme is dismantling oppression, building solidarity, a Green Party for everyone. And we are going to be focusing on a single theme and a single track of workshops and peer education and learning in a way that we really haven't in previous annual national meetings. We have arranged for some really amazing grassroots-based facilitators to help us bring the Green Party into the next necessary stage of evolution to ensure that as an organization, as a political structure, that we are putting into practice our values regarding anti-racism, anti-oppression, and solidarity. Because one, we want to run the kind of political party that reflects the values that we want to see in broader society. And two, we will not be able to overcome the most powerful, financially entrenched political cartel in the history of this country and possibly civilization unless we are able to enfranchise and have meaningful participation and leadership from every possible community and identity in this country. Solidarity work of this kind is not just about trying to be enlightened or it's not an act of charity. That's why we use the term solidarity. It's because we are all depending on each other. And to the extent that a group like the Green Party excludes or marginalizes folks or perpetuates systems of exploitation or exclusion, not only are we victimizing or re-victimizing communities that we seek to represent in government, but we are actually cutting our own efforts off at the knees because, and this goes back to the 10 key values and how they're all intertwined, there can be no grassroots democracy without social justice. The two go hand in hand. And just as the other 10 key values kind of necessitate putting the other ones into action in order for any of them to be really achieved. So that annual national meeting is going to be from July 15th to July 18th. And people can learn more about that and register at gp.org/ANM.
Well, Michael, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you, the Green Party, and how they might become involved if they so choose?
Our website is at gp.org, and you can find us on social media at Green Party US. That is our Facebook page at Green Party US. We're at Green Party US on Twitter and also Instagram. And we have a Facebook group in addition to our Facebook page. And we encourage people to please do sign up at gp.org to get on our email list because while we make use of social media as a tool to reach folks, we also understand that they are dominated by multi-billion dollar Wall Street entrenched corporations that do not really have many of the users' interests at heart. And so find us on those social networks if that's the easiest place for you to find us. But please do visit us at gp.org and sign up so that we can keep in touch with you in case Twitter or Facebook decide that we're too radical to keep existing on their platforms.
I like that last point, Michael O'Neill. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. I think you did a great job helping people gain a better understanding of the Green Party, which has a lot of positions that merit consideration. It'll be interesting to see where the party goes from here. So once again, Michael, I wish you and your party continued success. And thank you again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for having me.